Welcome to The Wrap-Up, our podcast that gives you an insider's look at the top stories in Hollywood. I'm your host, Jaren Waxman, the founder and editor-in-chief of The Wrap. And please welcome my co-host for this week, The Wrap's assistant managing editor, Adam Chitwood. Adam, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be making my debut here on The Wrap-Up podcast.
I know. But apparently you are like a podcast veteran, so I better bring my A game.
Oh, I just talked nonsense into a mic for like 6 years and some people paid attention.
Six years. Okay, well, I've only been talking nonsense into a mic for 2 years, so you've got that on me. Okay, here we go. We are going to have all things Sundance in this podcast. I'm going to be sharing some of my Sundance interview highlights, including my conversation with the one, the only Emma Thompson, who is the star of the movie Good Luck to You, Leo Grand, where she will be addressing in her interview doing a full nude scene at 62, age 62. And I'll be talking to the director. You know her as an actress, but now she's a director, Eva Longoria, and the subject of her documentary, Oscar de la Hoya. The film is called La Guerra Civil, a documentary at the festival that follows the rivalry between boxers De La Hoya and Julio Cesar Chavez in the 1990s that sparked a cultural divide between Mexican nationals and Mexican Americans. But first, let's dig into this week's big headlines.
Game of Thrones alum Peter Dinklage slammed Disney over its live-action retelling of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, which is set to star West Side Story actress Rachel Zegler. During an appearance on Mark Maron's WTF podcast, Dinklage said he could not believe Disney was actually revisiting a narrative about dwarves. He said, "I was a little taken aback when they were very proud to cast a Latina actress as Snow White. You're still telling the story of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Take a step back and look at what you're doing there. It makes no sense to me." On Tuesday, Disney responded with their own statement, reading, "To avoid reinforcing stereotypes from the original animated film, we are taking a different approach with these seven characters have been consulting with members of the dwarfism community. We look forward to sharing more as the film heads into production after a lengthy development period." Instead of dwarfs, Disney will fill the void with a group of what they describe as magical creatures, according to casting sheets that The Wrap has seen, thanks to our exclusive reporting. That was not in Disney's official statement.
But we know that's true. Magical creatures.
That magical creatures
is a little
vague,
let's be honest. It's a little
yes. Vague. So, and they could have just come out and said it's not dwarves, but instead they said they are consulting with the dwarfism community. So, a little confusing as to what exactly they're doing there.
Super confusing and kind of unlike Disney to sort of step in it culturally, right? They're usually like right on top of this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, with Aladdin, they had, you know, there was backlash to Guy Ritchie directing that. And then, you know, they went out of their way to cast the appropriate actors and actresses in that live action retelling. They have their new Little Mermaid coming up. They've got Halle Bailey in the lead role. She's a black actress in the Little Mermaid.
I mean, they flipped a lot of those animated movies to be black leads.
Right. And Barry Jenkins is directing the Lion King sequel. So, you know, they seem to be on top of it.
Barry Jenkins and Moonlight.
yes. So you're right.
On the back lot, if I ever saw one.
It is unlike them to be so caught off guard in this way.
Yeah. They also let that thing run through the news cycle for 24 hours before somebody woke up and decided to say, put out a statement saying, "Oh no, there's not really going to be dwarfs in this." Because it was like, when I saw that Peter Dinklage had that statement, I'm like, hell yeah. And you know, like what, like, are they really? And also it does kind of beg the question of kind of how you go back and remake a lot of movies. Like, there are some movies that are in the Disney vault, like Song of the South, that will never see the light of day ever again, right, and will not be remade unless they did Song of the South with a sort of woke black cast. If Disney, you decide to do that, I would like a small commission for that idea. Thank you. But there's just a lot of stuff from our cultural past that probably we can't really do again. And Snow White and the Seven Magical Creatures doesn't have the same ring to me as Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. But even when I say Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs right now, I kind of feel uncomfortable even saying that title.
Right. And it feels like they're just kind of running through the Rolodex of which films have we not done live action retellings about and maybe didn't even think about that. To me, the fact that statement came late and the fact that statement was a little wishy-washy tells me that maybe they weren't prepared for this. Maybe they hadn't thought seriously about that. Whereas with other remakes, it seems like they, from the get-go, knew they were going to do something different.
Right. Or that maybe they were more focused on the let's make Snow White a character of color piece right. of it and less focused on the little people piece of it. Right. Very interesting. Okay. So this week we learned something else in the cultural sphere, that out of 276 films that were released in 2021 that are eligible for Best Picture this year, only 75 of those films had a woman listed as director. That is 27.1%, which is down slightly from last year, when 100 of 366 eligible films, or about 27.3%, were directed by a woman. This, of course, is basically it means they're flat in the gender equity department, which is a bummer. You know, what do you think about this, Adam?
I mean, I don't know. This stuff is always, to me, a reflection of Hollywood. You know, they can only nominate the films that Hollywood makes. And so it's a further reflection of the lack of parity in Hollywood. But also, I went back and I tried to find some stats on, like, what is the Oscar makeup? In 2020, the Academy was only 32% female, which, you know, they've gotten better, but they're not at parity yet. So I think it's too
when it's not now to it is now 32%.
It was in 2020. I couldn't find numbers for 2021
that's interesting.
Of the demographic makeup, but you know, I feel like it's a reflection of both Hollywood but also the fact that the Academy is still, despite like pushes, largely white, largely male, largely older. And especially that directing branch is largely male. That's why you don't see a lot of female directors nominated.
Right, right. Well, I mean, we just, you're right. We have to get more female directed films in the pipeline. We'll be talking later about Sundance. Lots and lots of female directors at Sundance for the second year in a row. We're really happy to see that, because eventually, you know, one of those directors is Chloe Zhao, right? Who I met at Sundance probably 6 years ago now, the director of Marvel Eternals, but also of Nomadland, won Best Director, First Asian Woman, et cetera, to win the Oscar. But, you know, in just those are the people that get plucked from the independent world to do studio movies. So I think that Sundance pipeline, honestly, is really pretty friggin' important. Because those voices emerge and they get work, you know.
Well, and at last year's Sundance was Rebecca Hall's Passing, which was eligible for Oscars this year as a female directed film. We haven't seen the nominations yet, but you know, we'll see how that goes. But you've also had
confident about it because we put Tessa Thompson on the cover of the Wrap magazine.
Well, it's just to say that there's not a lack of great female directed film this year. You know, Maggie Gyllenhaal earning all that praise for The Lost Daughter, Jane Campion, possibly maybe the front runner for Best Director.
Who knows?
Yeah.
I think she is definitely the front runner for Best Director. Yeah.
Right. But I also, I mean, to me, I see this trend of really great female filmmakers in television. I mean, Karen Kusama just directed Yellow Jackets. You know, this week,
out of the independent film world.
Right. And now she's, you know, she directed, you know, the buzziest TV show of the last few months. This week, everyone was raving about the episode of The Book of Boba Fett, directed by Bryce Dallas Howard, who has directed some of the best episodes of The Mandalorian. So there's a lot of like Mimi Leader, Victoria Mahoney, Rachel Morrison, Leslie Linka Glatter. All these women are doing great work in TV. Where are their movies? Where are the producers and the studios that are willing to bankroll their creative prospects?
Good point. Okay. Over to you.
So Sharon, did you watch the Kansas City Chiefs Buffalo Bills matchup on Sunday night?
I did not.
I did not either. But apparently we are in the minority. More than 42 million people tuned in for the game on CBS and Paramount Plus. And joining us to talk about these astronomical ratings is the Wrap's TV reporter, Tim Basinger.
Senior TV reporter.
Senior TV reporter. That is
Don't
a copy.
Demote the man.
Hey, Tim, what in the world is going on? Why are so many people watching football?
I mean, first of all, football, NFL, is such a ratings anomaly. It's defying gravity, where everything else is shrinking. They're just growing and growing in more importance. I mean, you basically had a weekend that I think is being rightly considered as probably the best weekend in the league's history. Mm. That second round of the playoffs, which is known as a divisional round, It is usually, in my opinion, the best weekend every season because you have four games, two on Saturday, two on Sunday. It's the best eight teams, so you're almost always getting at least a couple good games that weekend. Mm-hmm. This year, you had all four games, all ended on the winning points being scored. One of them went to overtime, that Chiefs-Bills game, which had two lead changes in the last minute, featured two of the best quarterbacks in the league. You know, it airs in the Sunday, in the Sunday afternoon window, which is always the highest rated window. They always put the biggest game, and that game was considered to be the game of the year. Some people thought that was the Super Bowl without being the Super Bowl. So, you know, it was a confluence of events. You had
Tim, I have to tell you something. The clamor on my Twitter feed about this game was so strong that I almost tuned in to watch it. I didn't, but I came close. I'm like, what is everybody talking about?
Yeah. It was, I mean, that's the thing. The games themselves were just amazing. And personally, I watched the 49ers game when they beat the Green Bay Packers in sub-zero temperatures in Lambeau Field, which a ratings nugget I think is being kind of missed is that Fox said that game on Saturday night or Saturday evening for us West Coasters was their most watched Saturday telecast ever.
Ever. I saw that.
Wow.
Which okay, so what does this mean? Like, we need more football games? We need more football, like, to save linear television?
It means that the NFL is still so popular, the most popular thing. Live events still hold up TV.
Live sports, Tim. Because you can't say that for the Oscars.
You are correct. It's live sports. Mm-hmm. The NBA ratings have been up this year. I definitely think over the last, you know, half a year, the return of crowds to the games, I think, has lifted viewership because watching games being played in empty arenas and empty crowds just wasn't that much fun. And it was a constant reminder of COVID.
Okay, now I'm going to have to ask you a very impolitic question, which is, if football is such a bonanza, if it's like one of the last remaining super valuable programming you can put on linear television, what does that mean for all of these kind of brain-related injury questions that, to me, have, you know, is the elephant in the room around this great American sport?
Yeah, I would say about 5 or 6 years ago, right around the time that Will Smith movie came out, Concussion, mm-hmm. It was much more in the public consciousness. I mean, ESPN, to their credit, they reported on that stuff very extensively, and some think that caused the league to give them a crummy Monday Night Football schedule for a couple of years as sort of a payback. Yeah. That was under John Skipper. Since Jimmy Pitaro's taken over, he's definitely wanted to steer them more into, like, let's just focus on the sports of it and take out mm-hmm. all the other stuff, including the politics stuff, you know, the kneeling with Kaepernick. And so, yeah, it's not that people aren't aware. I think everybody's very aware of the head injuries, which is why a lot of segments that they used to air where they would show, like, these big hits don't happen anymore.
They don't.
Mm. You know, so it's – you look at it a little differently now, and I don't think people have forgotten about it, but it's – part of it is just because it's 5 or 6 years ago, it was being reported as, like, a new thing. Like, people are not talking about this enough, so we're going to start talking about it.
Yeah, but we still have people, you know, either committing suicide or you know, murder or dying, you know, older football players. Mm-hmm. This has not gone away, and so presumably it's not going to go away. And it makes me wonder, is it going to be one of these horrible realities that we live with, like we do with mass shootings of guns, because we are incapable of making a decision that goes against the financial and political interests of some major entrenched special groups?
Yeah, basically, well, is the NFL uncancelable for probably all of these, like, corporate interests, but also, like, your father grew up loving this team and your grandfather mm-hmm. grew up loving this team? Is it
and
just
it's great.
Kind of a,
you know. I mean, yeah, the games themselves, I mean, they're great drama in these games. And I think the fact that, you know, the league still is as popular, if not more popular than it's ever been, despite this knowledge being out there and everybody being very aware of this, I think there is some level of compartmentalization that fans have given of, you know, it's if the difference from now versus 10 years ago was, if you're someone who wants to play football now, you're a high schooler going to college or college wanting to go in the NFL, you can't act like you didn't know this was a possibility anymore. So you kind of go in knowing That's your fate.
If you choose this as a career,
it's a violent sport.
That seems terrible. I'm sorry.
I have friends who like having kids. They're like, they love football, but they're like, my son will never play football.
Yeah.
I will never allow him to play football.
No, I mean, okay. I think you asked
So glad I diverted this conversation from a talk about ascendant ratings, Tim, but I couldn't help myself.
No, it's a fair question.
Well, Tim, you tackled some interesting industry news related to Nielsen this week for the Wrap Pro. Talk us through it. There was an error in their out-of-home measurement that cost networks millions of dollars.
Yeah, so what happened was, I think in December, Nielsen admitted that their big ballyhooed out-of-home measurement system that they were rolled out at the end of 2020, that networks, especially networks who air live sports, have been clamoring for, because their argument was, you're missing a lot of viewership, people that are watching games in bars or watching games at their friend's house or watching in their offices or whatever. So now they rolled this out, and it was adding about 10% usually to the viewership number, especially for like football games, especially. And then in December, Nielsen came out and said, well, okay, so we have some software error caused us to undercount this measurement from the start, since we've been rolling it out for the last 16 months.
Oh my God.
Which by itself is bad. The fact that it was like their second or third admission of undercounting viewers.
Right.
When they're consistently getting hammered by networks who for years have been complaining as people move to streaming and watch stuff on Hulu and Netflix, even that like it's not an accurate number of what that Nielsen rating is. So I would say 2 days ago, the Video Advertising Bureau, which is like this research group that's sort of represented by the major TV networks, they put out a report because they got, I think, half of Nielsen's reprocessed data. And they basically found that through 8 of those 16 months, they accounted that there was about $350 million worth of ad time that was gone, that marketers mm-hmm. could not buy, which means networks could not sell, of missed data, missed impressions. So they said, well, if that's 8 months of the 16, we'll double that. And that would mean that there could be as much as $700 million worth of ad money that was just left on the table, or that never existed at all because of an undercount. Basically, they said that every night in the primetime ratings was missing about 400,000 people every single night.
I'm running a network, I'm losing my shit over this. What? Because you're a prisoner of Nielsen, and they've been complaining. I remember Les Moonves, I wanted to say God rest his soul, but he's lying. used to rail about this all the time. And
Zaslav, too. He's been a big guy who's hit them a lot.
So what now?
The thing is that advertisers, and now they have every reason to want to still use Nielsen currency, because they're probably paying less for what is actually viewed. So you have to get them to agree to some other measurement system. And anybody who's tried to come and replace Nielsen, especially on the digital side, it's just never got off the ground.
This is the same conversation we're having about football. It's the same conversation. It's like entrenched power, entrenched, like broken models mm-hmm. just – you're going to stay there because it's convenient for everybody and nobody can agree on an alternative. That's dumb.
And then what happens is you have the networks, NBC Universal has been big in this, who try to come up with their own, which, okay, that's probably great for you. But if I'm Viacom, CBS, if I'm what's going to be Warner Brothers Discovery, what is my incentive to use a competitor's measurement system? You know, so it's until some third party can come in and do what Nielsen has been trying to do, it's going to always be this way. And the advertisers have every reason to keep it that way because they know.
Do you know how old Nielsen is? Is it like from the 1950s? Is it even before
that?
It
might be older. It used to be people making journals and diaries on what they wrote. And that's actually what money was traded on.
More accurate. Okay. Well, thank you for lightening our day, Tim.
Bringing all the good news.
Exactly. That's what I do.
You made us smarter. That's more important. Thank you.
Thanks, Tim. Now for a segment we call Wax On, Wax Off, where Sharon gives her thoughts on her favorite person or moment of the week. Sharon, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Adam. All right. My wax on this week. We touched on it earlier. Women at Sundance. You really cannot miss the trend. Women filmmakers who are showing us a vision of the world through their eyes has matured and become a part of Sundance that feels like, and I hope I'm not speaking wishful thinking, that is not going away. There were three films about abortion that I wrote about in my column on Sunday at this year's film festival, a documentary and a feature film about an underground abortion network, which is an amazing story about women who conducted illegal abortions in the late 60s. And you will hear my interview with the people in that film next week. Story about, at the same time, a film about by a French female filmmaker about a young woman in the 1960s in France who really wants and needs an abortion, insists on getting one. There's a documentary about infant mortality rates among Black women, also made by two documentary filmmakers. There are just so many stories being made. Alina Dunham has a new movie. Emma Thompson, who you'll hear my interview with her, has a film about the sex life of a woman in her 60s. This is such a welcome richness that's been brought to Sundance, and I salute Sundance for that. That's my wax on. My wax off is I want to point you guys to a really well-reported story we wrote on The Wrap this week, in which we revealed that the entertainment mogul Ryan Kavanaugh, along with others, are leaving California. He's moving to Florida, which is something that he had not talked about publicly before. His parents have just left. Ryan is somebody who I do know. He was born and raised in Brentwood, upper class suburb of Los Angeles, and is leaving to Florida, which is, you know, obviously a pro-Trump state in general. It also does not have state taxes like California, which keeps raising taxes. But people are talking about the rise in crime, the scourge of homelessness, which is getting worse, not better, the cost of the state, the wildfires, the environmental disasters. People are leaving the state. I urge our leadership, our government of California, because I love California, to listen and pay attention and take action. We got a lot of blowback. I got a lot of blowback myself personally on the story, as if to say we were supporting or giving comfort to a right-wing arguments that the liberal state of California can't keep its shit together, can't implement policies. Well, California also has a very big budget surplus, and it's doing very well in a lot of ways. But facts are facts, people. And you guys who are in charge of the government of California are not solving these problems, and they are getting worse, and high value people are leaving. That's my wax off.
That's it for Wax On, Wax Off. Next up, our Sundance 2022 coverage. And I'd like to welcome the Wraps Awards editor, Steve Pond, who's joining us to discuss the news out of the film festival. Welcome, Steve.
Hi, Steve.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Okay. What do we need to know about Sundance 2022?
What do we need to know? I mean, I wrote a piece earlier this week that said it was just sort of sad. Last year I felt like, okay, Sundance went virtual. We all knew Sundance would have to be virtual last year. This year we were teased. We thought that there would be a real Sundance, and then they were forced to pull the plug, at the beginning of January. And, you know, watching a lot of very good movies in my living room on my TV, mm-hmm. I just felt like these are movies I should be seeing at the Eccles with a full crowd. It just...
Feet freezing and you're starving to death and you're trying not to doze off in the middle of the movie because you didn't sleep very much. You mean like that?
Yeah, I do mean like that, because I think that sort of... that breeds a camaraderie. The feeling in a big theater at Sundance when you see something for the first time, like, I mean, Sharon, you and I both remember being there for Beast of the Southern Wild years ago.
Yeah.
And walking out and going, what the hell was that? Or the screenings of a powerful documentary, the Kirby Dick Amy Ziering one on sexual abuse on college campus. I mean, there's just such a feeling in the room. And, you know, more than
well,
ever before,
also not to mention, Steve, when you do that, like I've been at so many documentaries Oh my God. I mean, this goes way back to before the rap even existed, but I'll never forget being at the After Innocence documentary screening where all of these, which was about people who were wrongfully convicted, Jessica Sanders documentary, and like 25 guys who've been wrongfully convicted, like stand up in the room. I mean, it's electric. You're right.
Yeah. I mean, you don't get that on a virtual Q&A, and there's nothing Sundance could have done about it. And they tried to, you know, create these experiences, but it just felt more than ever like, you know, I realized what we've really missed by not being able to have in-person film festivals. And that's independent of the fact that there were, you know, there were a lot of very good movies at Sundance this year.
Mm-hmm. What did you love? Go ahead, Adam. Sorry, you go.
Well, I was going to say, I'm curious about the couple of films. At my previous outlet, I covered Sundance for the last 7-8 years, and I did virtual Sundance last year. But of course, everyone knew that would be virtual. A lot of films pulled out. So the crop of contenders felt a little bit different. How did it feel to you this year with, you know, everyone or most of the films presumably would have been playing in person? I know a couple pulled out.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it felt like a usual Sundance in that for me, the documentary section was really strong. I mean, Sundance has always been great at showcasing documentaries. Yep. And I think they were again this year. You know, I find that the narrative films tend to be hit or miss, but there were, you know, a few that I loved, including Sharon, the one you were talking about, Good Luck to You, Leo Grand with Emma Thompson.
I thought that was great.
Which I think Searchlight was very smart to buy. You know, for me, the strongest ones were things like, there's a documentary called Descendant by Margaret Brown that was about the last slave ship that came to the United States in 1860, which was like 40 years after it had been outlawed. And they, you know, brought it over with over 100 enslaved people from Africa. They immediately burned it so that it couldn't be found. And they've recently found it. And it's a beautiful documentary that talks to the descendants of the Africans who were on that slave ship. And it turns out that Questlove, who had the big hit of last year's Sundance, is one of the descendants. He's not in the movie, but he's
Are you kidding?
No.
Wow. Oh my God.
He's a descendant of someone who came over on the Clotilda, which was the last slave ship.
Just to ask Steve, were the people I will watch the movie, but were the people actually enslaved? Since we're talking 1860 and the Civil War is about to happen.
Yeah, I mean they were enslaved for about 5 years, and then they were freed, and they actually formed their own community outside of Mobile, that has variously been called several things, including Africa Town. And that community still exists, and it's surrounded by factories because of zoning. But that community exists and is trying to thrive and to commemorate what happened there.
I saw last night this movie that people were talking about that sold today or yesterday for $15 million, Cha-Cha Real Smooth. That's in competition. I thought that was really great and was just a great example of a new voice, you know, what Sundance does best, which is showcase a new voice. This young man, Cooper Reef, who wrote it, directed it, and stars in it with Dakota Johnson, and she's great in it. Just really, really just charming. You know, the same way I felt about Coda last year, that it was just like, you know, Sean Heder's not a new director who directed Coda, but still, it was like, I felt like I was watching something really fresh and really different and new, and I felt that way, even though this is just a romantic story. Boy falls in love with girl he can't get, who has an autistic child. It's really lovely. Just, I wouldn't touch it, you know?
Right. Yeah. I have not seen that one. I heard very good things about it. I know our review was very positive and you know, it does sound like one of, you know, it wouldn't be Sundance if there wasn't one of those that at least one of those to come out and say, hey, here's a voice. And I know the director had been at Sundance a couple of years ago with his first film, I think. But, you know, I mean, and you know, maybe they overpaid for it. It sold for $15 million, I think. And most deals of that ilk at Sundance don't turn a profit. But I'm glad that, you know, Sundance has got a deal like that this year.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think that's probably all the time we have, but we're going to talk about Sundance some more with some of the interviews from our studio. And Steve did a ton of interviews at our studio. If you are listening to this and you want to see our Sundance coverage, you can go to therap.com and click on the Sundance tab in our navigation bar. That's the easiest way to find all the coverage, the studio interviews, the reviews, the articles, Steve's wrap up, and more. Thank you, Steve.
So this Sunday marks the end of Sundance. Across 10 days, the event, as Steve told us, was held virtually again this year. The festival included more than 80 feature-length films hailing from 28 countries. 39 out of the 92 directors of those films were first-time feature filmmakers. And Sharon, I know you spoke with several of the casts and filmmakers of those films.
I did at our studio, which we unfortunately built here in Los Angeles, but with a Sundance spirit. But yeah, so many great, great interviews we were able to do. And among them was Good Luck to You, Leo Grand, the cast of that film, which starred Emma Thompson. She plays Nancy. She plays a woman called Nancy Stokes, who is a retired school teacher who is looking for some sexual adventure. So she hires a very hot young sex worker named Leo Grand, who's played adorably by Daryl McCormick, or I should say very sensitively. And the film will stream exclusively as an original film on Hulu. At our studio, I got to talk to McCormick, the director Sophie Hyde, and of course, the star of the film, Emma Thompson, who opened up about embracing her age, her opposition to plastic surgery of any kind, and doing a sex scene and a full nude scene at age 62. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Amazing. Well, what a delightful film. What a fun, intimate, totally awkward, and like spot on performances and topic. Sophie, let me start with you. Let's tell people what the movie's about.
Sure. Yeah, it's about a woman who has led a, I guess, fairly conventional life and done things as she expects or she feels like other people have expected her to do them. And then she hits a point where she decides to hire a sex worker so that she can experience what good sex is for the first time in her life. Mm-hmm. So the story is about Nancy, that woman, and Leo, who's the sex worker who comes in, and the experiences that they have together.
And so Emma, of course, you play that woman, and who better to embody all of the difficulties that come with just honestly approaching aging and how our bodies are changing and our own sexuality. Talk a little bit about how you felt taking on this role. And I have a million questions for you always, because we've watched you, if I can say, we've watched you over decades bring yourself to the screen. And it's been wonderful to have an image of somebody who actually does not fight her age. You have aged with us on the screen. And I personally, as a woman of a certain age, appreciates that you've had the courage to put yourself out there, because it helps us connect with you as an actor and as your characters.
It's interesting, isn't it, that one, it's sort of regarded as courageous just to do the normal thing of just sort of getting older.
Yes, it is. But it is courageous.
It's strange, isn't it? But there it is. And I suppose therein lies the sort of essence of one of the essences, because there's so many essences of in this film. You know, that Nancy's someone who, as Soph says, has fitted herself into the woman-shaped boxes that are available to us all. When we grow up and we come out of our childhoods, nice or nasty, whatever kind of childhoods they are, into the wider world, and we see what we're supposed to be, you know, impossibly perfect bodies, you know, good wives, loving mothers, but also able to run a business and cook, and all of the bit boxes, all of the things that we're supposed to be able to do, all of the bullshit that we're at, that is thrown at us from very, very early on. And Nancy, of course, has had to live with that and has ticked an awful lot of those boxes very successfully. And then has, when her husband dies, the sense of emptiness inside her, the sense of a kind of unlived life, becomes so intense that she does something quite anarchic that's contrary to every tenet of her moral and emotional structure, really. Mm-hmm. And she hires this sex worker, I mean, it's something that she wants desperately, but that it, she finds very, very difficult to actually experience. And it's Leo, the sex worker, who gives her the tools, the skills, I suppose, that she needs to undertake this endeavor. He challenges and asks her questions that she doesn't expect to be asked. She has had all sorts of assumptions about this young man that are turned on their head. And in fact, they both have assumptions about one another that are constantly upturned. And so it is like seeing two people excavating one another. You know, it's like watching sculptures appear. You know, one person walks into the room, at the end of the film, two completely different people walk out. And that's what can happen between human beings if they allow themselves to be open with one another, when there are not masks and games being played and roles being played and boxes being ticked.
Daryl, what was it like going toe-to-toe, and other parts as well, with Emma Thompson?
Yeah, I mean, extremely daunting, but an incredible privilege as well. And I think what was so particular about the film was that we both loved it, and we both were entering at it in a sense of just honoring what was captured in the script. So it's a question that's popped up so often, and I've been so privileged to share this film with Sophie and Emma. But
well, talk about the first day. I mean, the first day you're on set, you didn't, I presume you didn't know Emma Thompson before this film, or did you know her before?
Of course I knew Emma. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I've grown up watching Emma, and you know,
I mean personally know her. I didn't mean to know who she was.
No, we didn't. No.
So she's a stranger as a person to you.
Yes.
Of course, you know her work, of course.
Yeah.
So how do you sort of get yourself to a mental place of, I'm totally deserve to be here, and it's going to be.
Yeah, that was a process in itself.
Yeah.
If I'm honest. I think the day before we actually started shooting, I remember one particular moment where Sophie pulled me aside, because we were kind of blocking the first day of our shoot for the following day. And I was struggling kind of to accept that I was meant to be there. You know, I think it's easier to maybe say, accept that if the film involves a lot of other people, but there was something particular about this film that it is shared between two people. So it did take me some time. But again, I think it just came down to us being actors and artists trying to bring this script to life, and that we come from different walks of life. And that was what we were offering, you know. And in some sense, we came in with like an equal, an equal foundation, which was incredibly surprising.
But it's also to do with the writing, you know, the parts often in film scripts, you know, there's imbalances, but Katie Brand had written these two characters in the most extraordinarily balanced way. And I was saying earlier to somebody that I couldn't have played this earlier and Daryl couldn't play this later, that somehow these parts hit us at our ages, at our level of experience, not only as actors, but also as humans, at just the right moment in time. This doesn't always happen. It's just one of those things that, okay, it was a very magical kind of meeting of minds and trajectories. It doesn't happen very often like this, that Katie wrote something that was so right for the pair of us at that moment in time, that was so right for Sophie and Brian in their careers as well. just one of those strange, magical things that happens sometimes.
It's beautiful. And there are actually more and more roles that I'm noticing for women, let's say over 40 or over 50. There's more roles. Certainly it used to be, I don't know, in the 90s, the odds, we really didn't see very many, and certainly not a leading role, although you're co-leads, right, in this film. It does feel like there's more, right? Doesn't it?
I think so. I mean, I don't think it's, you know, eye-wateringly more.
Right.
It's not kind of, oh my God, thank God.
Well, there was a time I remember thinking it's like Meryl. Anymore. I used to think Meryl Streep's the only person who'd get cast. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right. I mean, from my point of view anyway, but then I've always been a character actor, so I'm not having to let go of any sort of ideals of beauty or body that have, you know, I think that can dog you, actually. So from my point of view, I've done more interesting roles in my 60s than at any other time. I've only been in my 60s for a couple of years, so that's pretty good going.
Have you ever considered changing?
Brain surgery.
Yes. Surgery in general, just to try to, it's your vessel, right? It's your...
Why would you do that to yourself? I simply don't understand. I think it's, I mean, I think, I do honestly think that cutting a part of yourself off to put it in another place in order to avoid appearing to do what you're actually doing, which is aging, which is completely natural, is a form of collective psychosis. I really do think it's a very strange thing to do. I've always thought that, though. I mean, it's not something that, you know, but I've always been a card-carrying kind of militant feminist when it comes to women's bodies and what's been done to them, what we're told to expect of ourselves, what we're told to do to ourselves. And I think that one of the great triumphs of this story in this film is that, you know, it presents the untreated body for, you know, one of those very rare moments. So let's see what happens.
I love the idea of collective psychosis. It is a tremendous amount of pressure on women actresses to keep up or to change, or it's so I do have to salute you for being you, staying you, because we recognize you on screen as you, as the person we knew. And by the way, you know, we earned the wrinkles and everything with time. That there's wisdom that comes with that, I have found.
Yeah.
Sophie, did you like directing Emma Thompson and Daryl McCormick? How was that?
I mean,
terrible. She herself is a director, of course.
Like, so what? I mean, no, it's like it was pure delight. Like, both of them, you know, Em is like, you know, people keep asking Daryl what it's like to be working with them, but it's for all of us to watch somebody at the peak of their work, like the top of their game. To be part of that is always deeply thrilling, you know, and to be working with someone that's so smart and intuitive about story, but also just excellent to work with, like just not an asshole, is
that's always great,
you know. And same thing with Daryl. Like, you know, you were talking about Leo, and I think that Leo and Daryl share something, which is a compassion for the other people in the room, mm-hmm. and a compassion for themselves. And both of them have worked on how to professionally show up without all the shit that goes on in your head, to professionally step into a room and be there for the person opposite them. Mm-hmm. And to me, like, having Daryl step into the role of Leo, we got to watch that, you know, every day. Even Daryl saying that he was freaking out, he was doing the work, just like Leo, I feel, would do to be able to show up for the person opposite him. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I couldn't imagine two better people in this. Like, I feel like in awe and lucky.
Did you feel like you learned anything from the actors? Because directors are different in the way they work, and this is such a actor-focused piece.
Yes, I think every actor works differently. And one of the jobs for me as a director is to work out how an actor works and to help help them do that. You know, it's funny. You work with big stars sometimes, and Emma walks into the room so ready, more ready than anyone else on that set, you know, just like always on time, always knowing everything, knows everybody's names. These are things that just feel like they're normal, but they're not always normal. And mm-hmm. You don't have to keep being consistently that generous to everybody sometimes, you know. And I learned a lot about that, about how to do that part of things with grace, you know, to not let the bullshit get you down, to just work towards what you're doing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you shot this during the pandemic, yes?
We did, which meant we got to spend quite a lot of time together. And we were cut off from, you know, the rest of the world. And, you know, there was no distractions. You know, we were very focused.
Mm-hmm. Did it, and so you shot it, was it in the UK? Is that in England?
We shot it in Norwich, yeah, in a studio in Norwich. And so we were there, all of us on school camp kind of vibe. Just going to work every day and working at night as well, because what else were we going to do? Yeah. And, yeah, there was four of us, you know, Emma, Daryl, and the cinematographer, Brian, and I. We just felt like we were investigating something the whole time and watching these two people and how they play out this story. It was one of the great pleasures of my working life, for sure.
Yeah, sounds pretty great. Emma, you talked about getting some of your most interesting roles now at this stage of your career. Can you talk a little bit about what else you'd like to do? What excites you? Do you still want to write? I know you write. Do you want to direct? Would you rather act and not writing as hard? I mean, acting is hard. I guess it's all the good stuff is hard. What do you want to do? What do you want to be doing?
I always want to be doing whatever it is I'm doing, which I've found is a great gift. It's just nice to be happy wherever you are, because then you're released from, you know, longing. I at the moment I'm engaged in making Nanny McPhee into a stage musical. So what I want to do at the moment is manage to get a really original, wonderfully anarchic and sort of dynamic piece of theatre ready for young people in particular, because I think that we owe children the best that we can give them, particularly now. So I'd love to make that happen. That's what I'm engaged in at the moment. So that's what I want to do.
That's really fantastic. And so acting is...
No, I won't be acting. I'm just writing.
You're just writing?
Yeah.
Oh, all right. Well, we like seeing you do all of it, but it's a particular pleasure to see you on screen. That's absolutely for sure. Well, I think that's all I have time for, but thank you so much for joining us at our studio. Emma, Daryl, and Sophie, congratulations on your film. Good luck to you, Leo Grand. And we look forward to having a great Sundance.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us. Bye.
And we have one more interview for you this week. La Guerra Civile is no ordinary boxing documentary. The film was directed by Eva Longoria Bastón, and it grapples with the legacies of two greats of boxing, Oscar De La Hoya and Julio Cesar Chavez. And it talks about how their respective backgrounds, both Mexican, sparked a cultural divide over what it means to be authentically Mexican. So Eva, who we love and know very well here at The Wrap, Oscar De La Hoya, and the executive producer Grant Best joined me for a conversation about this film. I am wildly excited to welcome the talent and the subject and the creators of a documentary that is going to be showing in the competition. In fact, it's going to be premiering shortly. It's called La Guerra or La Guerra Civil, because my Spanish isn't as good as it should be, soon to be corrected by the people you see on your screen. We are here with the director and the producer, Eva Longoria Bastón, a dear friend of The Wrap, the executive producer, Grant Best, and the legendary champion, Oscar De La Hoya, the subject, or one of the two subjects of this film. So welcome, very warm welcome to you guys.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And, you know, very much wish we were up in the mountains, but the film is as good as it is, whether we're in the mountains or not. I mean, the film is excellent, and I loved it. First of all, how am I supposed to say it? Somebody help me out here.
You did well. You said La Guerra Civil.
La Guerra Civil, okay. And it is about an epic standoff battle between Julio Cesar Chavez, who was the reigning champion in boxing at the time, and Oscar De La Hoya, who was to become the next reigning champion, but who was challenging this great lion of boxing. But what it really is about culture and who gets to own the Mexican identity. What does that mean to be Mexican, to be Mexican American? And Eva, you just brilliantly tell this very large story, which appeals to anyone who, whether you like or know boxing or not, through this epic standoff between these two great champions. So we're so lucky to have all you guys here. I was hoping we would have Julio Cesar as well, but we are very fortunate to have you guys. Let's just start. Eva, I know that you, through our many conversations through Rap Women, were already moving into the next phase of your career where you're directing, although I didn't know you were directing this. So how did this come to you and why did you decide to do it?
Yeah, it was all serendipitous. I've known Oscar for 25 years. We've been friends for an eternity. And and he came and he said, hey, you know, there's this 25th anniversary of this epic fight that happened. We want to do a documentary about it. Do you want to do it? And I was like, I don't want to do like a boxing doc. But that fight, like, it was so funny that he came to me about that fight, because that fight, I remembered how it divided my household. Like, I still remember the fight that we had in our neighborhood, and you know, just people, really our community, not the world, but our Mexican community was like divided. I mean, it was, you know, this you know, El Campeón de Mexico, you know, you don't touch Julio Cesar Chavez. And so my dad and my grandpa, like, everybody was for Julio, and me and all my cousins, we were all for Oscar because we were Mexican American. And so I just remembered my feeling. Right. Like, you don't remember what you said, you don't remember what people did. You remember how you felt. And so I just remember feeling that. And I said, that would be interesting to use this fight to explore that theme of what does it mean to be Mexican enough, and who gets to decide that. And that's why, you know, I think you find the film so enjoyable. You don't have to be a boxing fan. You don't have to be this film's about humanity. And it was really the story behind the fight. And this passing of the torch that almost didn't happen because of this cultural fight within our community. That's why it's called the Civil War.
Yes. So, Oscar, how did you feel about Eva framing your story? Because it didn't have to be that story. It could have just been about, hey, the young guy beats the older guy and then goes on to, you know, not quite take the entire legacy from him, because it's more complicated than that, apparently. But how did you feel about her wanting to tell the story through that approach?
Well, the fact that I know Eva for so long, and you know what she has put together in the past several years has been just amazing work. And so she was the perfect one, because she not only is a great director, but also lived that moment amongst her family. And so it was very important for us to make sure that whoever's going to tell the story not only tells it through the lens, but is also feeling it. You know, so she did an incredible job. It was well put together. I've seen it now like 6 times. every single time you see a moment that took place, and it takes me back. It takes me back to those times where, my gosh, the division amongst cultures, what it created back then was just, it was special. And she captured those moments perfectly.
So you wanted the story to be told in that way?
Absolutely. It couldn't have been told any better. Like she said, like Eva said, it's like, it's not a boxing movie. It's not about, okay, who wins and who loses. It's literally about cultures. It's literally about, it's so humane. It's so, I mean, it's just beautifully told.
Yeah, I need to understand better how Eva just like tossed off or like a really good documentary, because that's annoying. Let's just be honest. She's like so good at other things, and she's gorgeous, and she's
I want to do this.
We really don't like her very much.
No, but, it was really great, but like kind of what Oscar said. I grew up exactly like Oscar. I grew up in a Mexican household. We, you know, grew up. Our parents spoke Spanish. You know, I didn't grow up speaking Spanish. Oscar did. So by all sense and purposes, we felt Mexican, and it wasn't until
in America,
you know, right. and you know, we're here in the United States, and they're like, oh, you're Mexican. And then we go to Mexico and they're like, oh, you're gringo, you're American. And we were neither here nor there. And so that's the experience that he speaks to, is like Mexican Americans always straddle that hyphen of identity.
Yeah, exactly. So, Grant, I see a whole lot of statues over your shoulder, Emmys and such. What? How did you get involved in this?
They're not positioned perfectly at all. DAZN first and foremost, we're a live streaming platform. We stream live sports events, thousands of them around the world. And that's how we know Oscar, through Golden Boy Productions. But beyond those live events, we have started to build out our original content production. And we have tried to find stories that have not really been told. In this case, this one's not been told, which is fantastic for us. And La Guerra Civil, brilliantly directed by Eva Longoria Baston. We managed to get both contributors, both main characters, to be part of this film, in Oscar de la Hoya and Julio Cesar Chavez. And we were able to look beyond the fight itself. You know, boxing, probably more than any other sport out there, has never been shy, never been afraid, never been frightened of connecting itself with race, heritage, and allowing that to come through its fan base, its characters, and most importantly, the competitors in that ring. And, you know, we've managed to produce a wonderful film, directed brilliantly. And we are hugely proud that its debut in a film festival is Sundance. So yeah, for DAZN Originals, we are delighted. Great, great movie.
So Oscar, take us back to this time when this fight happens. The film takes you to the prelude, the previous years, and does a great job of setting up this epic fight. What was that moment for you? And remind us how old you were at the time and sort of what was in your gut.
Sure. I mean, oh my gosh. Watching this film, watching myself win the Olympic gold medal in 1992 in Barcelona, win it for my mother who passed away from breast cancer. Just reliving those memories are obviously very special and dear to my heart. But when watching it in this film, it hits me even closer because it was just perfectly told. The storylines, everything was just well put together. And, you know, those times were actually difficult because here I am as an Olympic U.S. gold medalist, okay, on a global stage in the Olympics in Barcelona. I come back to the States with my gold, and I become the golden boy at 18 years old. Mm-hmm. But when I face Julio Cesar Chavez, now I'm the gringo, now I'm the pocho, now I'm not from here, I'm not from there, from Mexico, from the US. So it's like there's this lost identity. I mean, those moments are just captured brilliantly. And so yeah, this film is just an amazing film.
So at the time, you were what, 19?
18.
18 years old.
At the time of this fight, 18. You were a kid, really.
No, at the time of the fight, I was actually 23.
That's right. So
for the Julio, but he won the Olympics.
Yes. But I meant the fight with Julio Cesar Chavez. So there you're 23. You're a young man.
Young man.
You're full of.
I have the world on my hands. And
yeah, exactly.
And it's incredible because it's funny how Eva, she included the fan base that I had, which was all women. It was a sport that is just dominated by men, right?
Yeah.
And she captured those moments brilliantly. So
like women throwing their panties at you.
Yes, and... it was just incredible. I mean,
it was more than that. I mean, obviously, Oscar is Oscar. You know, he happens to be good looking, but he backed it up in the ring, and so sure. You didn't have that in a boxer. Right. And that's what men wanted to be him, and women wanted to be with him. And he was one of the first athletes to bring women into the audience of boxing in the biggest way. And mm-hmm. Oscar is also the first person to do this crossover market. And we explore mm-hmm. that in the film too. You know, the fastest growing demographic in the United States is Latinos. So when you're talking about general market, you're talking about the Latino market. Mm-hmm. But this was in 1996, and Oscar was already doing it. He was already doing Gillette commercials in English and Spanish. He was already doing everything, you know, twice as much and twice as hard because he could straddle both borders. So yeah, it was.
Let's talk for a second, Eva, about your interviews with Julio Cesar. And we get to hear your voice in the background of these interviews. I'm like, that's Eva. And what was that challenging at all? Or you know, he is very revealing in this film about his foibles and his mistakes, or how his journey, how he thought he was invincible, and of course, none of us. Is invincible. Ultimately, at the end of the day, there's always a challenger, or their age comes into it, or other substance comes into it. And you know, he went into this fight not prepared, not physically prepared, and he admits that. But how was that process of your interviewing him?
You know, I didn't know Julio before this, and you know, Oscar really put all these pieces together. He's like, Eva, you're going to direct it. DAZN, you guys are going to pay for it. And I was like, but do we have Julio? And he goes, I'm going to get Julio. Don't worry about Julio. No. So, you know, Oscar delivered Julio, but I had never met him. And he's so charming and so funny and so self-deprecating and very honest. He is a truth teller. There is no revisionist history in his head. He remembers it as it was. He remembers how he felt. He remembers where he was. And he's very forthcoming about all of his the demons he was facing in this time, you know, because it really did affect his fights. And so he was such a joy. And every time, you know, we had to interview him a couple times, same as Oscar. There's just so much ground to cover. And every time he would come up from Tijuana, he'd meet us here in LA, and he's like, "I only came because of you."
That's really great.
"I only came because of you. Because this is a lot of fun, you know."
Because it's got to be painful in some way to face down those things.
Not now. I think back then, and he says it. He goes, "I would never have I did not pass the torch to him. There was no way I was passing the torch to him, especially after that first fight." Amazing. And it wasn't until the rematch and even after that he really finally gave Oscar the credit that was due. But he admits that now. He's like, "Oh my God, he was the better fighter." He goes, "I never would have said that after the fight. Never."
Yeah. But then Oscar, you ultimately did become if you became friends or you did have a relationship of respect and connection.
Sure. You know,
how did that happen?
Well, after the first fight, so he didn't give me the credit that I guess deserved. I beat him after the first fight. Mm-hmm. So he comes with an excuse, and so we fight again, and this is where like the whole being Mexican or Mexican enough. I felt that I had to fight him differently and fight him at his own game and fight him in front, like right in front of him. Mm-hmm. And whoever gets knocked out gets knocked out. And so the fact that I beat him at his own game, he finally gave me the recognition. He said, "Look, champ, you beat me. I my hat's off to you." But it was after maybe I would want to say like 10 years after that second fight that we really became close friends.
Wow.
We realized that we've been living almost the same lives. We've had struggles. We've had some victories. But at the end of the day, we're just human and people who just want to be loved, people who just want to be that just want a life with you know, yes, the celebrity was great and the highs were great and all that, but we just want to be with our family, with our loved ones. We want to be just normal. And that's where we connect. That's where we became like almost best friends. I can call him any single day whenever I want and just joke around with him, and we can meet up and have dinner, lunch. It's a beautiful relationship.
Yeah. So let me ask you, since it's 25 years since this epic match and the Mexican-American community was divided over it, and you went on to have this brilliant career, would you say that things have changed now in terms of Mexican identity or having to choose what's Mexican, who gets to decide what kind of what does represent authenticity in Mexican culture? Has that shifted?
Sure. And I mean, Eva can elaborate more on that subject, but I feel it's still
a problem.
Yeah, it's still a problem. It's still an issue amongst our community.
I mean,
we have this lost identity. You know, we don't know if we're from here or from there. And so this fight here just explains it perfectly. And Eva, you can talk more about it.
Yeah, I don't think this is why I wanted to explore this film through this lens, is because it was so relevant. The fight may have been 25 years ago, but the struggle is today. Mm-hmm. And so for our community, you know, for the Latino community, not the Mexican community, but like, you can be Cuban American, you can be Puerto Rican, you can be Central American. And the thing we say over and over is, you know, we're not monolithic, and we're not. I'm not saying we're the same, but we have way more similarities than we do differences. And we have way bigger fights outside of a ring. You know, we have the poverty, we have disproportionate, you know, effects of COVID, and we're disproportionately on the front lines, we're disproportionately sent to war, where, you know, we need access to education. And so if we don't aggregate and we don't figure out our similarities and figure out, we can fight this together and all benefit from this. And so that's kind of the message of the film, is at the end of the film, they did realize, you know, we're way more alike than we thought. And they've, you know, they have done things together. So if our community could come together and do things together, then we could win, you know, we could win the war.
Mm. Beautiful. Final question to Eva. What is the status on the films that you were, the feature films that I know you were working on, and then COVID hit and they got probably totally derailed?
This is why this one was serendipitous. I was about to start directing Flaming Hot, and then we got pushed because of COVID.
Right.
And literally, Oscar was the last meeting we had in person, and then there was shutdown. Like, it was the last time we actually met in an office and like sat, and we had DAZN there, and we were all there at Golden Boy. And then like the next day, everything shut down. But this, I knew we were going to have to figure out logistics, unlike a movie set where
But are the movies going into production?
I wrapped Flaming Hot already.
Okay, you're done. Okay,
we're in post on Flaming Hot, but I'm just saying, Flaming Hot was supposed to come first. This ended up, you know, squeezing in there right before Flaming Hot. I finished this and went right into prep.
Wow.
Flaming Hot, shot Flaming Hot on the second year of COVID. And now we're editing and we're in post now. And so that will be later this year or probably 2023.
All right. So you are a bona fide director with back-to-back movies.
And thank you for squeezing me in there.
I squeezed in this story. Because this particular medium, documentaries, is are so much archival footage. And so the interviewing part, we had to figure out logistically, because we had people in Las Vegas, we had people in New Jersey, we had people in New York, we had Jesus Rivero in Merida, you know, in the middle of nowhere in Mexico. So once I was like, let me get all of that in the can. I just want to get all the interviews. Then the majority of the film was going through all of this footage. and figuring out what was important. And then Grant had the wonderful task of having to option all of it.
Well, congratulations on the film. Great job. Oscar, so nice to meet you. Grant, nice to meet you too. Thank you for being here at the Wrap Studio.
Thank you.
We look forward to seeing the public reception to this film. I bet it's going to make a big impact.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great job. Thanks, you guys.
And that's it for the latest episode of The Wrap Up. Thank you to all of our listeners. And remember to please follow or subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts. Please be sure to rate and review us and let us know what you think of the pod. See you next time.